It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
It's all good. Hello, I'm your host, Bert Martinez. Welcome to Money for Lunch. And I want to tell you that it's all good. So you didn't get the funding you needed for your company. It's good. You get to keep more of your company. You get to get better at bootstrapping. You didn't get the promotion you wanted. It's all good. Maybe you can get better at your job. Maybe you can look for a new opportunity. It's all good. Maybe your best friend just passed away. It's all good. Your best friend was suffering. Now they're no longer suffering. It's all good. Good. If you can just start off by saying that, by realizing that it's good, it's for the greater good, that good things will come of it. Not in some denial kind of positive thinking kind of way, but the reality is that for every tragedy, there's that silver lining that we've all heard about. Something good can come out of it if you're open to it. So good, get out. Open new doors is what GOOD stands for. I'm trying to figure out maybe another acronym, but G-O-O-D. Get out, open doors. In my case, I'm saying get out and open new doors. So, it's all good. It's all good. The economy's up. It's all good. Everybody's happy and things are chugging along. The economy's down. People get better at saving money. People are more grateful. And grateful is good. It's all good. All right. Good show. We're ready to get started. My first guest, Marion Saunders White, a dynamic business and technology professor and owner of The Refinery, a management consulting firm that services the operational needs of small business owners. Marion is a skilled facilitator and trainer with over 25 years of corporate and entrepreneurial experience in leadership and development. Yeah, leadership and development, program and project management, business operations, business financing, contract management, and human resources. Marion, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Oh, thank you so much. Glad to be here today.
You bet. All right, so bear with me one second because all of a sudden my teleprompter started acting up and I just cannot see my notes. So for whatever reason.
Oh, not a problem. I love the way you opened the show with get out and open doors, and I'm going to take that with me today and just remind myself of that for today and the rest of this week as well. I love that.
Thank you so much. It's all good, right? It's all good. I mean,
it's all good.
It's all good. All right. So speaking of good, let's talk about leadership. I want you to first all help us out here because you have here 25 plus years of corporate experience and entrepreneur experience. What is leadership to you?
It's a very good question. And I think a lot of people, you ask 25 different people, you'll probably get 25 different answers. For me, leadership is a characteristic. It's a behavioral trait. It's not necessarily a title or, a lot of times people think of leadership or management, they're thinking of a business title or a corporate title, a title you strive to maintain in someone else's business, if not your own. But, for me, I really think it's a trait. It's the way you conduct yourself. It's how you respond to things. It's how you treat other people. It's your mindset in dealing with the things that you're faced with day in and day out. So that's, in a nutshell, at a very high level, it's a behavioral trait. It's the characteristics of those elements that make up you.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. And you know what? It is a characteristic trait. I think that we've seen examples of really good leaders and really bad leaders.
Definitely.
And it's just a, what do you call it? It's, you know, I think that both whether you're a good leader or a bad leader, some of those skills can be taught. You can learn those. And I think the major differences that I've seen is that, you know, I think a good leader really is concerned about, let's say, the mission or the people or the organization, where maybe a bad leader is more selfish, more egocentric. What do you think?
I totally agree with you. There was something that was going around pretty recently on social media, and it really had traits or characteristics of how you defined a good leader versus a bad leader. And it, to sum it up, it was a lot of the things you just said yourself, whereas a good leader is a person that's really concerned about the team and the overall mission and goals of the organization. And they try to promote their people and highlight their team and edify them as a team to others versus taking credit for themselves versus just sending, you know, the team off to do work instead of you guys go do this. Hey, how can we take care of this? Let us go together to do this. A good leader is a person who's willing to take, you know, credit for the team as a team. You know,
right.
Not just I did this, the team did this, you know. And
right.
At the same time, you know, when things, you know, aren't as well, aren't going as great, aren't as good, you know, willing to take the responsibility and the ownership of that. And, you know, you're not bad mouthing the team. So it's understanding that it's us, it's we, it's not you go do it or I take all the glory.
Absolutely. I like that a lot. All right, let's talk about this. What is your take as far as leadership? Can you learn from someone who isn't a great leader?
I definitely believe that you can. And it goes back to, you know, are leaders themselves, is that a natural talent? Is it something that can be learned? And you touched on that a little bit earlier. And I think it is something that can be learned or enhanced and developed. But it is a part of your core nature. So you have folks who are better leaders than others. Some folks you can develop. I hope you can. I built a large part of my business on trying to develop, you know, those really good qualities and characteristics to develop good leaders. But there's some folks who just aren't as good at it, and there's some folks that are pretty, you know, honestly pretty bad at it.
Right.
But there are things that if you pay attention, there's a lesson in everything, you know.
Yeah.
And if you pay attention, there are things that perhaps you see it as a negative. You don't like being around it. It brings a negative vibe, brings negative energy. You would say, oh, I would never do that. Well, that's a learning lesson. That's something that you can learn and take from that. Learn not to do that. Make sure you don't do that to your team or to other folks that you encounter. So you can definitely take some positives out of something that seemingly could be a really negative situation. I once worked for a person who we at times thought it was just a really negative vibe. So instead of just harping on that negative, you like make sure in my interactions I don't do that to others. Boom, that person was a mentor to me, probably didn't even know it, and most probably wouldn't have thought of that person as a mentor
right.
because you saw negative qualities. But you can definitely learn from that and move on.
No, I think that's a great takeaway. We're constantly learning if we're open to it, right? So you're right. I think a good example, bad example, they're both teaching us something. Right now, not to get political, but right now we have, three people on the GOP side that are still in the race for president. We have two people on the Democratic side running for president. So essentially mm-hmm. we have five leaders, and they all have a slightly different message. They all have slightly different leadership skills, slightly different way of delivering their leadership. So you can see back to what you're saying earlier that there is this,
exactly.
you know, there's not this cookie cutter thing. Hey, this is a leader. This is what you do. That, you know, all of these five people gunning for president are leaders, and they have these massive followings, and they all do it differently.
They all do it differently. And if you're smart and you're open to it, even if it's someone you don't particularly like or adore or want to follow, there's something that you can learn from it. If just going back to the presidential candidates, if there's something someone you're so opposed to, but you see they have a large following, look at the why. There's something in their message that's appealing. What can you
yeah.
learn from that and apply it to, you know, those attributes and those values that you believe in? So you can definitely learn. Lessons are out there.
Yes, I like that. Lessons are out there. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back with Marion Saunders-White right after this. Stand by.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we're back. We are talking with Marion Saunders-White about leadership. And interestingly enough, we're just talking about the different styles. And one of the things that I like that she brought up was you can learn from bad leaders as well as good leaders. Somebody that, you know, might be doing a poor job. Why are they doing a poor job? Why aren't they being liked? Why did they get fired? Why did they, you know, whatever. You can insert the scenario in there. But there's a learning opportunity there, just as there is with good leaders. Let me ask you this. You know, when it comes to being a leader, are there any books or resources that you like to turn to or look to when trying to develop a leader?
Yes, there's a lot of information out there, and anyone who's ever attempted to pick up any kind of reading can tell you that there's a lot of information out there. So you pick up stuff from different things. I'm also a very faith-based person, so a lot of the materials that I like to read are also faith-based as well, and it's really interesting how you can take that and incorporate that into your everyday life and corporate life as well. I like to read things by John Maxwell, who's really great. Actually, some of the folks that I, when I went to school, was getting my MBA, some of the professors that I had at that time, I was reading some of their things, so they might not be as widely known, but I think it's interesting. So I really like to go to that. And just it's interesting reading just about anyone's leadership material that they put out there. There are tidbits that you can take from it. Some things apply to you, some things don't. A lot of times it depends on what your experiences up to that particular point has been as well.
Yes, absolutely. I like that. You know, it's so interesting how we as humans grow or change or evolve, because exactly what you said, you hear something, or maybe you take a training and maybe you don't get a lot of it. It doesn't really apply to you. And then somewhere down the road, that training all of a sudden becomes meaningful to you, or that book becomes more meaningful to you, or whatever, because now you're experiencing that. You've grown and you've seen things, and so therefore it makes more sense. I like that. You know, and I think that the other thing, speaking of leadership, I think a good leader in general, good leaders tend to be good readers. You're constantly getting better. You're trying to increase your people skills. You're trying to, increase your skills in general. Right.
Exactly.
I don't know. Any quote leader who isn't constantly reading, going to a training class or a seminar or taking a digital course, something to get an edge, if you will, to push themselves to be better.
No, I totally agree. And all of us will say we're so busy. And even those of us who, you know, give workshops and give classes and trainings. Exactly. We need to keep up on the times and, you know, the latest things that are going on and, you know, put our opinions out there as well. So I try to take, you know, online classes, webinars as well if I can't necessarily get out. You know, try to read a couple pages of a book every day. You know, there's a couple different books that you may have open at a time, but you definitely want to increase your knowledge intake, you know, so you can go ahead and you know, on it, your thoughts, your opinions, and then prepare your information for when you're out there actually, you know, mentoring and coaching others as well. So you definitely have to, you know, stay well-read, you know, whether it's the magazines or the books, podcasts are great because you can just listen to them, you know, on the go. So
yes,
there's so many different avenues to get that information. It's important we do stay, you know, well-versed.
Absolutely, absolutely. Marion Saunders-White, thank you so much for stopping by and sharing. It's been a blast.
I appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity. And, you know, make it a good day.
Absolutely. Make it a good day. Good stuff there from Marion Saunders White on leadership. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to get into it with Brian Sullivan with Sandler Enterprise Selling right after this quick commercial break.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool. You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
All right, we are back. The good folks from Sandler Training are back today. Brian Sullivan is co-author with David H. Matson of Sandler Enterprise Selling, Winning, Growing, and Retaining Major Accounts. Winning, Growing, and Retaining Major Accounts. Sullivan is vice president of Sandler Enterprise Selling at Sandler Training. Man, talk about good branding on the word Sandler, right? Talk about it. All right. Brian Sullivan, welcome back to Money for Lunch.
Thank you, Bert.
All right. So, you know, let's get into this. Your new book is Sandler Enterprise Selling, Winning, Growing, and Retaining Major Accounts. First of all, for us who may not know, what is enterprise selling? How is that different from, let's say, regular B2B selling?
Yeah, so that's a great question, Bert. You know, at Sandler, we typically look at things in terms of pain, because, you know, pain's the great motivator. And so we look at enterprise selling in terms of some of the unique pains and challenges that you face in selling into enterprise accounts as opposed to, you know, to smaller or medium-sized accounts.
So when you say enterprise account, I mean, are we talking, what, like $1 million sale or a $10 million sale?
Yeah, so it's not as much the you know, the size as it really is the issues, the challenges that you face in selling into enterprise organizations. Bert, you're looking at situations where the sales cycles are really long. You know, you're going up against sophisticated competitors in everything that you do. And when you make a decision as an organization to go after an enterprise deal, you're typically making a commitment of a lot of your money, your resources, and your energy to do it.
Okay, so give me an example. When you say really long, 6 months, 18 months, what do you consider really long?
Well, I mean, it's relative, right? So in selling into small organizations, you can quite often have a sale be consummated in days, a week, you know, maybe a month or two. But in selling into enterprise organizations, you're looking at certainly months. In some cases, multiple years can go by over the course of a large enterprise deal.
Wow. Yeah. Could you imagine, you know, incubating something for 18 to 24 months? That is just ridiculous. But at the same time, you're also looking at maybe something many, many, many years ago in a galaxy far, far away. I was a runner or a gopher for an oil and gas company. And some of their sales were $20, $30, $40, $50 million. And yeah, they would take, I remember taking, you know, 18 plus months to close a deal.
Well, yeah, absolutely. You know, and the longer the time goes, just as is true of anything, the longer time goes, the more uncertainty and doubt and risk enter into the equation. So it's a frustrating time for selling organizations, but by the same token, for the organizations that are really good at what they do and where they're prepared for dealing with this extended sales time, it can really be an advantage.
Okay, so how can it be an advantage?
Well, if you think about it, you're being evaluated by the prospect organization over time by the way that you carry yourself. And in an extended period of time, you have an opportunity to prove, you know, your dependability, your attention to detail, you know, your follow-up. You have an opportunity to prove that you do what you say you can do. And truthfully, if you're up against some competitors in a deal like that, you know, they might not have the attention to detail that you have. They, you know, they might just kind of drop the ball occasionally, or miss a deliverable, or, you know, perhaps issue some boilerplate response as opposed to a customized response. So again, the organizations who are prepared for it are in a much better position to show the prospect what they're going to be like to deal with as a business partner after they've won the business.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. All right, let's talk about this. Tell us a little bit about the Sandler Enterprise Selling. What is it? You know, what is this approach to selling?
Yeah, so Fundamental Sandler, if you have any familiarity with it, Bert, Fundamental Sandler is a selling system that's really been around since the late 60s, and it's a really powerful program that bases itself in the beliefs and the attitudes of salespeople. And we took the Fundamental Sandler selling system and we enhanced it for organizations, again, who sell into the enterprise arena, and enhance certain areas such as, you know, all the work that you do in territory and account planning on the front end, and then really on the back end, a heavy, heavy focus on what we call service delivery. And what we mean by that is that it's after you've won the business that you really have an opportunity to win more. So it's your ability to be able to focus on the client's needs as you deliver over time that position you to really expand and grow one of these really large accounts, like the kinds of deals that you saw years ago in the oil and gas business.
Gotcha. Now, let me ask you this. With the Sandler Enterprise Selling, can this approach be adapted for other types of selling situations? I ask you this because, you know, if you're a mom and pop and maybe you've never sold, you're used to selling $100,000 deals, and now you're about to sell your first $1 million deal, that could be a little spooky.
Yeah, no question. So the precepts of this program can really be used with any type of sale, but it all scales, if you will, Bert. I mean, if you think about it, one of the tools that we use in our program is something called Pursuit Navigator, and it helps you make decisions about the deals you're thinking about pursuing to help you understand your likelihood of winning. So before you start, you know, spending all that money and time and energy, you better be able to make a good determination based on your understanding of what you do well and the profile of this prospect, whether you should go after the business. And so whether you're a huge systems integrator selling into one of those oil and gas companies you talked about, or whether you're a small HVAC services firm in a local geography selling to a law firm, you better be able to take those things into account. It's all a question of understanding the issues prior to entering a deal, whether the deal is going to cost you $40,000 to go after or $400, it all scales.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. All right, let's talk about this. In the book, you talk about one of the six stages in the book. You refer to it as service delivery. Talk about that. What can the sales team do in conjunction with the delivery team to expand an account? Talk about that.
Yeah, sure. So in some situations, you know, you have what's called like the handoff from sales to delivery, right?
And in many
cases, it's a bit of a dreaded handoff, if you will, because, you know, you as a prospect you've been dealing with a selling team for all this time, and they've been telling you all these great things, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're off to slay another dragon, and you're dealing with completely new faces. So the trust factor has kind of dropped through the floor. So we make a real key point here in service delivery that the sales team remains engaged with the delivery team to be able to take everything you've learned about that account and to learn even more to be able to grow your business with the account. Because, you know, things change once you begin to do business, Bert, because, you know, when you're pursuing a prospect, if you say, hey, what's important to you now, they're typically going to say things like, hey, you know, cut your price, cut your delivery schedules, give me more pro bono services. But, you know, after you've won the business, after the contract is signed, in many ways, things change. You know, the honesty factor goes way up. So as a sales and delivery team, we believe very strongly that you need to revisit how the client views success, because what you discover at that point is totally different than what you thought when you were dealing with the client as a prospect.
Yes. No, I like that. That and you're absolutely right. Anybody's experienced the handoff, it's just it could be a deal breaker. You know, you and I probably know, or you probably know better than I, that a lot of deals have probably been stalled, broken because of the handoff was so bad.
Oh, no question. And if you take for granted that when you're dealing with one of these major clients, I mean, they represent this ecosystem of opportunity, and for you to be so cavalier as to say, okay, now my sales guys are going to go off and find the next one while you delivery guys focus on what you're doing well and help me grow the account, it really doesn't compute.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Matter of fact, I think one of the best handoffs that I've ever seen was the salesperson that we were working with would routinely bring over the service manager to interact with us, thereby making it, you know, thereby giving us a different face. And so when the handoff took place, we felt very comfortable because it's somebody that we had dealt with and interacted with, we had lunch with, you know, we had seen at least 5 or 6 or 7 times.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, because we believe strongly that when you're selling to an organization, you should be exposing them to how you deliver. I mean, hypothetically, if you do a good job with delivery, if your products and services are good, why don't you personify that in the pursuit by introducing them to members of your delivery team? And by the same token, as we talked about before, you should need to have your salespeople actively engaged in delivery. And that's why we refer to it as kind of a continuous process of selling and delivering to major clients over the long term.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about this. You know, in the very beginning of the segment, you talked about pain points or the pain of the prospect we're dealing with. Why is it crucial for sales professionals to craft a solution directly addressing the specific, let's say, pains and needs of the buying organization? And if you can clarify a little bit what you mean by pain, and how does it does identifying the pain help establish the business relationship, the business?
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So but by pain, we refer to, you know, the motivation that a prospect has to take action. We talk about the fact that, people are unwilling to take action to resolve a problem situation until they clearly understand the level of pain they're experiencing. And so you, as a selling organization, need to know the client well enough, need to know their business model well enough to be able to identify the areas of pain. And once you understand that, that earns you the right to customize your solution to that particular client. Now, there's an investment there, no question. But in going after a large piece of business with a large client, you mentioned oil and gas before, it makes sense that you'd be investing so that your solution for ExxonMobil is going to be a little bit different than it would be for Shell. So that's what we refer to as in terms of customizing the solution. It's not that you have boilerplate answers. You take the time to understand the situation and understand the pains so that you've earned the right to be able to customize your solution, Bert.
Yes, I like that. I like that a lot because, you know what, one of the things that, as prospects, we like to have the sense that this is something not necessarily special, but at least this is something for us, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. And clearly, in making an effort to understand that as a selling organization, you can quite often determine that you are not the solution. You do not have the solution for this client. And that's where you avoid spending all that money on a pursuit that likely you'd not win because your solution is not the right one. And truthfully, you've also saved the prospect a ton of time as well.
Absolutely. I like that. Again, if people picked up on that, you're putting the client's needs before your needs. So what can I do for the client, or what is it that the client really needs? I really am not a perfect match for them. Let me either step out of the way or help them find somebody that is. But, yeah, you know, save them a bunch of time.
Yeah, we like to talk about working for the no. Because the earlier you can, earlier in a process, you can determine that it's not the right match. And we all know that in terms of, you know, human relationships as well, right?
Right.
You need to be able to understand as soon as you can so that you can save everyone a great deal of time and so that you can then redeploy everything that you have towards one of those deals where you really have a great profile match.
Yeah, no, I love that. All right, let's talk about this, because in the book, Sandler Enterprise Selling, you share many, many tools that assist with the sales process. The specifically one that I want to talk about is, I was trying to figure out how to pronounce it, but it's just an, it's, you know, it's, I guess an acronym. It's K-A-R-E-S-M, accounting plan, it's an account planning tool. Talk about that.
Right. So it's actually the CARE tool, K-A-R-E. And the concept.
Oh, you know what it is? You know what it is? I bet you the SM isn't supposed to, the SM, it might be like, what do you call it, a signature mark?
Ah, there you go.
So when they copied and pasted, it didn't copy and paste correct. So that's why it was, that's why they're, okay, CARE mark, okay, K-A-R-E makes a lot more sense. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. So you know as well as I do, Bert, you know, organizations have designations for their clients and prospects, whether they be vertical designations or, you know, your healthcare clients, your financial clients, whether it's geographic designations or sometimes designations built around the revenue size of an organization. And all those are, they're well and good. But what we say is you need to supplement that with designations that are meaningful and thought-provoking, designations about the traits and tendencies of organizations that help you build actionable plans. So we talk about identifying keep accounts, attain accounts, recapture accounts, and expand accounts. And just to give you a quick vision of what one is versus the other, the keep account, you know, they're your bread and butter accounts. They're accounts you feel great about. You want to have them forever. But they differ from expand accounts in that expand accounts, they're the ones that you're willing to make significant investments in. They are your future. They're the ones we like to say that you want to tuck in at night. And so understanding that accounts, traits, and tendencies fit those categories, in addition to all the other things where you know their size and where they are and whether they're healthcare or financial, that can dictate the actions that you take. So it really takes the psychology of you know, how we deal with other people based on what we understand their traits and tendencies to be. We take it to the account level, and we use CARE to be able to identify meaningful and thoughtful actions about our future with these customers.
Yes. No, I like that. Because, you know, what's interesting, too, is whether it's a $100,000 account or a $100 million account, the key component there is building that relationship, getting to know those decision makers.
Well, that's right. That's right. And understanding, again, you know, the differences between whether these are ones that you want to make significant investments in or they're just going to be your Pareto rule accounts, that's huge. And the other categories are attain, which are your profile targets, and then your recapture accounts, the ones that, you know what, for whatever reason you don't do business with them any longer, but you'd like to. And so by having accounts in that category, you can build action plans that would likely apply to all the accounts in that category. So you don't need to be reinventing the wheel for every single account. You have a process to go to based on the designation.
So we have keep, attain,
recapture, and expand.
Recapture and expand. I like that. Right. Yeah, I like that a lot.
The other nice thing it does, it gives an organizational lexicon for you about accounts. So when you're talking to somebody from the accounting department, you're referring to an account, they say, what is it? You say it's an R account. They're like, okay, I got it. Go ahead, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I love it. And you know what? The other thing that I like about this CARE is that so many businesses are always looking to expand, and they forget about the importance of attaining and then recapturing, right? So many of us ignore clients that have left us, but they're sometimes the easiest ones to go back and reactivate.
No, you're exactly right. That's been a huge aha moment for us in taking Sandler Enterprise Selling to the field. So many clients have come back and said, oh my gosh, you know, just that recapture concept, which to me is the simplest thing in the world. They said, wow, I went out right away after using Care and I won back two customers we had 3 years ago in the first 2 weeks. And so sometimes you need to have reminders of things that, you know, are pretty fundamental, but you need to have them be in your action plans.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So let's talk about this, because you guys devote an entire chapter to client-centric satisfaction. Not client-centric selling, but client-centric satisfaction. What does that mean? How is the client satisfaction in the Sandler Enterprise Selling a key to long-term sales success?
Yeah, and we do get that question a lot, Bert, because to be honest with you, you know, customer satisfaction, like how can that be something that helps you sell, right? So you need to think about it. So you just stayed in one of those chain hotels a few days ago, and you got that email from them that asks you to fill out a survey form, and you're asked to evaluate your stay on friendliness of lobby personnel or cleanliness of room or the comfort of the shower cap, right? But your room was next to the elevator and across from the ice machine, and you didn't sleep a wink, but room noise is not one of those choices you're given. So you're likely going to delete that email, and you're absolutely not going to stay there again. And that's the concept about client-centric satisfaction. As we talked about earlier, how things change from when a prospect becomes a client, we say you go to the client, typically with a selling team and delivery team together, and you ask the client to define the factors that are most important to them. You ask them to pick five, and you ask them to provide weights. And then you walk out of that meeting, sales and delivery, and maybe the first one chosen was communication. And the salesperson says to the delivery person, communication, did you know about that? They said, no, never came up in the pursuit. So let's say you built this plan to have bi-monthly status meetings with the client. Now you know that communication is the number one item to that client. Maybe you're going to shift it to have monthly status meetings for the first 6 months, because now you understand how important it is to the customer. So by asking the question and understanding what's most important to the customer, immediately you're able to increase the chances you're going to be more successful in delivering. And by doing that, Bert, you're in a much better chance to grow the account. But so many people don't even bother to ask the question. They just take off and delivering, hitting their dates, doing a great job, without ever going back and saying, now that we're together, tell me what's really important to you.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny that you mentioned that hotel email, because that's exactly what I got this morning, because I was traveling last week, so I thought that was funny.
Well, there you did. And how was your shower cap, by the way?
Exactly. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, you know what? And it's so interesting, too. Look, I know that many of us have talked about this, but I think it's worth mentioning again. You look at Amazon. Amazon is built on this client-centric satisfaction. In fact, when you call them now, they want to be not the biggest bookstore, which was originally their tagline, not the biggest retailer, which was their other big tagline, but now they want to be the client-centric satisfaction company. They talk about, you know, they want the happiest clients in the world. And it's working out really well for them. I mean, if you call them up and say, hey, you know what? I'm not happy with this widget I just bought. Oh, no problem, Mr. Martinez. We just credited your account. Please mail it back.
Right.
You know, and one time they said, you know what? We just credited your account. You can keep it, donate it, you know, throw it away. Oh, okay. I mean, because it was only like a $10 item, right? So it wasn't that big of a deal. And then Amazon acquired Zappos, the shoe seller. Why? Because Zappos was all about client-centric satisfaction. They went over and above, you know, trying to make their clients feel good and happy and satisfied or over-satisfied, right? I mean, they didn't sell the cheapest shoes. They never talked about the price of the shoes. They only talked about their client centric selling or client-centric satisfaction. That's what their whole thing was, and people love them for that.
Yeah, so that's a great point. And the point is, if you don't ask, you won't know. And of course, selling is so much about asking questions. And once you've recovered from that client I mentioned, the communication was the number one item to them moving forward. You didn't know it before, and you make those changes to make your status meetings happen more frequently. That client feels so happy. They see the email that talks about the status meetings being increased in frequency, and their socks are going up and down because you're directly addressing the things that they told you are most important to them. So
yes. I love it. All right, Brian Sullivan, always good. The book, again, is Sandler Enterprise Selling, Winning, Growing, and Retaining Major Accounts by McGraw-Hill. Sandler Selling, is that right? Sandler Enterprise Selling. It's available on Amazon. Brian, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Bert, pleasure. All the best.
All righty. Good stuff there from Brian Sullivan. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to come back and spend some time with Brian Miller. Brian Sullivan, Brian Miller. You know, Amy, find us another Brian between now and the end of the show. This would be fantastic.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. Brian Miller has spent the majority of his life working in and around nationally recognized multimillion-dollar family corporation, the Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. His parents built the family business from scratch, starting with just one dealership in 1979. The risks they took and the lessons learned along the way have shaped Brian into who he is today. On May 1st of 2013, Brian created Miller Inspiration to help promote company culture as well as provide professional training and personal development using the lives and lessons and principles of Larry H. and Gail Miller and the company they founded. Brian served on the board of Larry H. Miller Charities from 2004 to 2007 and currently serves on the board of directors for Larry H. Miller Group of Companies. Brian Miller, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right. You know, and it's interesting, too. I'm excited to have you on the show because I've seen Larry H. Miller, all over, I think you guys have a pretty big stake there in Utah, right?
That's right. We're headquartered here in Utah, but we do business in some form or fashion coast to coast.
Okay, well, great. So here I saw Larry H. Miller. I spent a lot of time. I lived in Utah and for many years, but I just couldn't stand the cold anymore, man. But it's still a wonderful place to live, wonderful people that live there. But what I found interesting or what I did not know is that Larry H. Miller was your father. I always thought Larry H. Miller was still around town.
Yeah, he is my father. He passed away 7 years ago, so now he's a memory and a brand that's still with us. But pretty amazing guy.
Well, that's wonderful. And you know what's really cool about this is that part of your motivator is to talk about the memories and lessons learned from both your dad and your mom, Gail Miller. And because really our mom and our dads are so important to us. And if you happen to be in a situation where your mom and your dad are both entrepreneurs or business owners, it's a different lifestyle than mom and dad who work for a living.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, there's a lot to be learned from anyone who's successful, but Larry was unique in the sense that he was not only successful, but he was also a teacher. So it's been a real privilege to have been a part of this company for so many years, have seen firsthand the way he lived, he worked, he thought, and then also to have the benefit of the things that he shared personally. So it's been a really incredible privilege.
Let's talk about this. I always like to ask my authors, why this book? How did this book come around, or what was the inspiration behind this book? Talk about that.
So this book, Behind the Drive, was the fulfillment of a promise that I made to my dad shortly before he passed away. You know, I always thought that my dad would die of a heart attack at his desk because he spent so much time there and he pushed himself so hard. But it turns out that we knew the end was coming because his years of pushing himself had caught up to him, and he did have a heart attack, but he also had complications from diabetes and a number of other health issues. And he had a couple weeks to live. He got a diagnosis, and we knew he had a couple weeks to live. So we were able to spend some time by his bedside. And as I did one day, he and I were alone, and I was looking for what to share with him to connect on a deep level. And I told him, I said, "Dad, it's been a privilege to have been your son. And I will live the rest of my life both exemplifying and teaching things I've learned from you. But I want you to know that as I do, I know I'll always compare myself to you." And he said to me, he said, don't compare yourself to me. I don't know if you're more than I am or less than I am. I really don't, but it's not important. Measure yourself against yourself. It is enough. And as I took that and I processed that, you know, after he passed away, and I found myself, you know, really wanting to honor that promise I'd made to live and teach things I learned from him, this book was one way that I could do that, by collecting the experiences, stories from his life, from the people whose lives he had touched. I knew that if I didn't do that, all these would be lost. And they're just way too incredible to let that memory just dissipate. So that was it. I spent a couple years interviewing people, inviting them to write their story just in a couple pages. And the response was overwhelming. And some of the things I discovered about how he lived, worked, and thought were really just phenomenal.
This is great. You know, not everybody is going to be maybe as successful as your dad, Larry H. Miller. But, you know, I think one of the takeaways from this experience that I'm having is our fathers, our parents probably have a lot to teach us. Sometimes we have to take a step back and realize what they've taught us. And this idea of maybe, you know, writing a book from, you know, from what you learned about your dad and interviewing other people is something that everybody can do. Maybe they don't need to publish it. Maybe, you know, whatever. It's just a keepsake for the family. But what a neat idea. I mean, what you did there, I think, is a wonderful example of, you know, the love that you have for your dad. And obviously, he had a very positive impact on you. So congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. And I agree with you. I think it's true that everybody has a book inside them, you know, in the same way that everybody has something to contribute. And this book was a way for me to really explore, you know, what it was that made my dad successful, because he was an ordinary person. You know, I think we look at people who are phenomenally successful and we think that they're somehow different from us. Right. And part of what I wanted to achieve in this book was to help people understand that we're all capable of making extraordinary contributions. We all have our own form of genius. And if we tap into those things, then we really can live a life we love and we can make a difference in the world. And you're right, we won't all necessarily be as successful financially, maybe, as some of these extraordinary entrepreneurs, but that doesn't make our lives any less important, and it doesn't make the contribution we have to make any less significant.
Yeah, absolutely true. I love that. I love that. And what I want to, you know, go back to what I started with in the intro here is that, again, your dad started with one dealership in 1979. And what happens sometimes is people will look at somebody like, you know, a Larry H. Miller or a Donald Trump or a Bill Gates, and they go, "Wow, man, this guy is so successful. I could never do that." Well, you got to back up. You got to see the 20, 30, 40 years ago when they started with, you know, essentially nothing.
Yep. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And that's one of the things that I share with people about this is that, you know, again, Larry was an ordinary person who accomplished extraordinary things because of the extraordinary commitment he had to making a difference in this community, to providing good employment, you know, to providing scholarships, which is philanthropy. And so what I came to see that I didn't have any idea I would discover when I started this book is that there was a formula to Larry's success. And I think that that same formula is available to all of us. And it's very simple. And what it is it's do work you love, get better every day, and serve something bigger than yourself. And again, the way that we might do that is different for each of us, but we can all do that. And
yes.
Exactly what you said, where Larry did work he loved, he got better every day, and he served something bigger than himself over a career of 40-plus years. Yeah, you know, you're going to make an impact if you do that.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. All right, let's talk about this real quick. Is there one story that surprised you that maybe stood out from all the other rest that maybe made the biggest impression on you?
Yeah, there is. There's a story. God, there's so many. If you ask me tomorrow, I'll give you a different answer. But they're all so good. But one of them that really just blew me away was a story about a gentleman who came to Salt Lake from the Ukraine right about the time, the end of the Soviet era, and he had come to study democracy and free enterprise. And for some reason, he came to Utah and he got connected with my dad. You know, that he was asking for prominent people around the state. And my dad made time to talk with him and his delegation. And from that grew a friendship. Well, this friendship, it turned into something where this gentleman, whose name is Peter, his wife, Natasha, ended up getting very sick back in Ukraine. And we believe it was probably due to complications from Chernobyl, actually. But point is, she was sick, and in Ukraine, they didn't have the technology to save her. And even if they sold everything they had, they couldn't have treated her properly. So Larry arranged to have her brought here to Utah and work with the top oncologist in the state, and ended up saving her life. And there's just a touching line in that story when he says, "Peter, when I offered to help you, I didn't say I would help you for $5,000. My offer was to help you regardless of cost." And then Peter goes on to talk about how this literally saved Natasha's life. And Larry's generosity and his selflessness, again and again in every story, it's an act of service. And they're not all that big. Some of them are much smaller. But sure. I got to see that success was achieved by providing service to others. It wasn't something he did after the fact.
Yeah, what a wonderful story. You know, that's a great legacy. And it's a great lesson that you've learned there that, as you said, not all of them are that impactful or that big, but that you were able to watch service being performed. And I want to bring this out a little bit, because the media sometimes loves to malign the successful, right? That, you know, that they're so, you know, that they're all business, that they're uncaring or unfeeling. And we're able to see, as you said, you know, Larry H. Miller is just a regular guy doing what regular guys do. And he was, he had achieved extraordinary success, and that he used that success to serve others, such as Natasha and some of these other people that nobody knows, but
right.
Maybe, you know, your dad and you and the family.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Larry was either too busy doing this to talk about it, or he was too humble. You know, I think Larry believed in the saying that, you know, if somebody knows about it, it's not truly charity. That was
right.
It was, he just kept it quiet. He went about and did the work.
I think there's a spiritual reference or a scriptural reference to I can't quote it, so I'll paraphrase it. Something about, you know, if you go and do good and then you brag about it, well, there's your reward. You got it. But you do good and you kind of keep it secret. You don't need to boast about it. Your God kind of knows what you've done, and you'll be rewarded in that way.
Yep, absolutely. I think Larry totally believed that.
Let me ask you this. What do you hope people will take away from this book?
You know, I hope people take away from this book two things. One is that I hope everybody who's listening to this and anybody who might pick up this book Behind the Drive would get that you are capable of making an extraordinary difference in the world, that you have an innate genius within you, not just talents and gifts, but a genius. And when you begin to operate from that place and you begin to do work you love and contribute to others, that's when you'll find a vein that you can mine where your life can become so rich and so filling by serving others. And you can do that. So that's the first thing. But the second thing I hope people who are listening to this or who pick up this book will take away is to preserve your health. You know, Larry died at 64 years old with his legs amputated due to complications from diabetes. And that was the consequence of not eating right, not exercising, not getting enough sleep, not going to the doctor, you know, living under high stress for decades. And although he made an incredible contribution, he paid an incredibly high price. And I don't think he had to. And so without your health, you have nothing. I think Larry should still be here. You know, he died before he even reached the age of senior citizen. So I hope people take away that they're capable of making an extraordinary contribution and that they should protect and preserve their health.
Yes. You know, how many times have we seen that? Somebody who becomes so successful and they trade their wealth for their health. And obviously, this is one of those things where passion, you really have to, moderate your passions. Because obviously what got Larry to be so successful is that he was so passionate and so driven.
Yeah.
And then at one point, it would have been nice if he would have said, you know what, I'm already here. Let me slow down. Let me start, you know, focusing on my health. Let me start, you know, because if you figure somebody with that kind of drive, if he would have focused on his health, you're right. There's no doubt he'd still be here.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Let me ask you this, because again, this is from a son, you know, from one son talking to another son. What personal lessons have you learned from your dad, both on the good things and maybe the not so good things that, you know, that our fathers, you know, because our fathers are all human. So anything like that, any takeaway from the good and the not so good?
Yeah, I would say the good. One of the things that I learned from him that he demonstrated by example was to be a man of integrity. You know, Larry, there's a story in the book about he loaned someone $1.5 million on a handshake. And that was just how he operated. He didn't need a contract. His word was his bond. And he used to say that his reputation was his most important asset, even over owning an NBA team or any of the dealerships or other entities. It was his reputation was his single most important asset. And his reputation was built on integrity. So that's one thing that I've taken away as what I would call a positive or something I strive to emulate. I think another thing is his authenticity. You know, he was who he was everywhere. It didn't matter who he was with or what he was doing. He let you know, what he wanted and what he didn't want and how he felt about you and what he didn't. And some people, when they do that, they can be a real jerk. And at times he had a temper, it's true, but you always knew he cared about you and he was always real. So the integrity and the authenticity are absolutely two things. And I think those are key to his success. It's not a coincidence that he had those. You know, I think a lot of us feel like we have to wear a mask or we can't really be ourselves. And he wasn't that way. And that's why I think a big part of why he's successful. On the what I would put on the negative list is what I said about health. You know, the fact that, and not just health, but spirituality and his relationships, all of those three things suffered for a long time, especially while he was getting his business up and running. And my mom will talk about how she was angry and she was sad growing up. She raised five kids basically as a single mother because he spent 16 hours a day at work, 6 days a week for 20 years.
Wow.
You know, so I would say really working to balance that and looking, recognizing that your experience of every day is as real a measure of your success as your net worth or any accomplishment, even though it's far less observable. So
right.
That's what I would say I've learned.
Yes, I like that. It's so funny listening to you talk about your dad. Almost word for word, you describe, you know, my dad, the passionate, driven workaholic. My mom also, you know, raised us for the most part by herself because he was away so often. And very authentic kind of guy, kind of, like you said, kind of tells you how he feels, when he feels, what he wants. And and all that other good stuff. You know what? Let me ask you this. We've talked about diabetes a couple of times. Have you any personal connection with diabetes? Do you do any work with the Diabetes Foundation or anything like that?
Yeah. So with this book, we made a $100,000 contribution to the American Diabetes Association. So we do have a charitable partnership with them on this project. And then our company has also been a supporter of the ADA over the last few years.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I think that's a great tribute to your dad as well. Brian Miller, it's been wonderful to have you on the show. Looking forward to having you back another time. And I love what you've done here for your father, Larry H. Miller, and also for your mother, Gail Miller. It's just a great tribute to them, and it's a wonderful book. And thanks for stopping by.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
All righty. Good stuff there from Brian Miller as he recounts his dad, Larry H. Miller. Larry H. Miller, just if you're not familiar with the name, Google him. You can see that he is all over the map, accomplished a lot of things, including owning an NBA team and all sorts of other different investments. As always, you know, we strive to bring you some of the best stories, shakers, movers, leaders, whatever you call it. I think this story with Brian Larry H. Miller is a great story. There's a lot of lessons there. And the book, let me see if I can find it. I lost it. But the book is by Brian Miller. And for some reason, I can't find the name of the book. And just a lot of nuggets there about family, about health, about being successful, integrity, all those things. Remember, you were created to succeed.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch and check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.